You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. President Erdogan says the demonstrations in support of the jailed Istanbul mayor have turned into a movement of violence. He said Turkey's main opposition party was responsible for damaging property and harming police officers and vowed it would be held accountable.
We as a nation have followed with astonishment the incidents that quickly turned into a violent movement. After the calls to the street made by the leader of the main opposition party following a corruption operation centered in Istanbul. 153 of our security personnel were injured in 5 days of attacks by marginal organizations and city bandits.
Earlier, Turkish police said 1,100 people had been detained in the violence following the arrest last week of Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. He's been officially selected by the CHP party to be its candidate in the next presidential election. President Donald Trump has announced secondary tariffs of 25% on any country that buys oil or gas from Venezuela and then trades with the United States. The measure comes into effect next week. Our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
Among the countries potentially affected by the secondary tariffs are China, which buys more than 60% of Venezuela's crude oil, and India. In a post on his Truth Social site, Mr. Trump accused President Maduro's government of purposefully and deceitfully sending tens of thousands of violent people to the United States. These, he wrote, included members of the Tren de Aragua gang, a powerful criminal organization that operates in the U.S. and across Latin America. The U.S. has recently deported more than 200 alleged Venezuelan gang members to a notorious high-security jail in El Salvador.
The Chinese electric vehicle maker BYD says its revenue topped $100 billion for the first time last year. That's slightly more than the earnings of its main rival, the US firm Tesla. BYD sold more than 4 million vehicles in 2024. US and Russian officials have been meeting in Saudi Arabia as President Trump continues to push for a swift end to the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin has sought to dampen early hopes. The Russians are keen to revive a deal in the Black Sea, which allowed them to export farm produce and fertilizer in exchange for refraining from attacks on Ukrainian shipping. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, is in Riyadh.
If they can achieve even one of those aims of securing Black Sea shipping lanes or coming up with a deal that safeguards critical national infrastructure like oil depots, electricity generating stations, things like that, that will be definitely progress. It's not the full comprehensive ceasefire that the Americans agreed with the Ukrainians in Jeddah a few days ago at the previous talks, but it would be progress.
Frank Gardner reporting from Riyadh. You're listening to the World News from the BBC. Ukraine's foreign minister says Russia must stop its attacks instead of making hollow statements about peace. Andriy Sybiha said any diplomacy with Moscow must be backed up by firepower, sanctions and pressure. He was responding to Russia's missile attack on Sumy, which has injured 74 people. Israel has intensified its bombardment of Gaza, launching airstrikes on targets across the territory. Homes, mosques and tents belonging to the displaced are all reported to have been hit. Palestinian health officials say at least 60 people have been killed in the renewed assault. They say more than 700 have died since Israel resumed its military campaign a week ago. The intensification follows Israel's targeted killing on Sunday of a prominent Hamas leader. Tunisia's launched an investigation into tax fraud and money laundering by several private ride-hailing apps, which it didn't name. They're alleged to have used undeclared bank accounts to siphon millions of dollars out of the country. The government says the companies have been suspended and their local headquarters closed. Several million dollars have been seized from their accounts. The French film star Gérard Depardieu has appeared in a Paris court, accused of sexually abusing two women during a film shoot 4 years ago. The 76-year-old has faced claims of improper behaviour from around 20 women. Hugh Schofield is in Paris.
Suffering from diabetes and a heart condition and looking very overweight, Gérard Depardieu entered the courtroom leaning on the shoulder of his lawyer. Of the several sexual harassment allegations that have been made against him, these are the first to come to trial. The plaintiffs, a set decorator and an assistant director on a film made in Paris in 2021, say that he groped them using lewd language. Depardieu's lawyer has been holding forth in this first session of the two-day trial, saying that the investigation into his client was biased and that he has witnesses from the film set who will say nothing untoward ever happened.
Hugh Schofield reporting. That's the latest BBC News.
When we reached out to our volunteers and to you, our listeners, and asked for your help during the recently concluded Winter Pledge Drive, you responded. Thank you.
If you got a problem, don't care what it is. If you need a hand, I can assure you this. I can help. I got two strong arms. I can help.
Because of you, we reached our goal for the drive, including matching every dollar of the challenge grant, welcoming 143 new donors, and welcoming back many more. Now, it's our turn to focus on playing the music you love, the news you need, and the civil discussions that make sense of the issues. It's our turn to help.
Six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your Monday host, Douglas Haynes. In a time when public trust in government is near historic lows, today's show highlights regional efforts to educate and engage young people in the political process. The Legislative Semester is a nonpartisan civics and government curriculum that engages students in the legislative process. This curriculum is expanding rapidly in Dane County and beyond, despite a toxic political environment and widespread fears about talking politics in the classroom. At the same time, Madison High School students are organizing a coalition to advocate for a state constitutional amendment to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in school board elections. On A Public Affair today, we have two guests to tell us about these two initiatives to get young people involved in the democratic process. We have here in the studio at WRT Ada Lambeck, who is a senior at Madison West High School and a member of the West High School Civics Club. Welcome to A Public Affair, Ada.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we also have with us, joining on the line from Ashland, Wisconsin, Kate Arnold-Ullman, who is coordinator of the Wisconsin Civic Learning Coalition and executive director of the Legislative Semester, Inc., a nonprofit organization that supports a semester-long high school government and civics curriculum that engages students in a simulation of the legislative process. Welcome to Public Affair, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to welcome listeners as well. If you have a question for my guests or want to share a perspective on civics education and youth engagement and democracy, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. That's 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to have you join the conversation today. Ada, we're going to start with you. We're very fortunate that it's spring break and we can have a high school student in the studio with us today. So we're going to start with your voice and just give us a sense of, from where you sit at Madison West High School, what's your sense of youth engagement in the political process these days?
I think, especially when it comes more to national politics, students don't always know exactly what's going on and who's doing what, but especially in the past couple of years, as things have gotten more serious and more personal, students have become a lot more involved. And when it comes to like those local issues, like when I talk to kids, like it's clear like they really care about this stuff and they really want to change the way that things are, and they're very passionate about these issues. So the more local, usually, the more they're going to know about it and care about it and want to make a difference.
Yeah, that's interesting. That kind of resonates with our experience here on A Public Affair, too. We often get the most calls for issues that are local, that people are very personally impacted by. What are some of those issues that you see high school students talking about?
Well, I mean, recently, West High School had a walkout after the shooting at Abundant Life Christian School. That's a very important issue to everyone at West High School.
Gun violence in general?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, for sure. And we're looking for more safety initiatives from the school board to protect us and our teachers in the classroom, because I can tell you some of those classrooms are not secure. And it's not very comforting sometimes. So that one for sure is a huge part of West culture.
Any other issues come to mind in particular?
I mean, local issues, for the most part. I think the gun violence is probably the biggest and most unifying out of all of them, since it's not as political as some of the other ones.
Kate, you've been a high school and college teacher. Have your experiences with student interest in civics matched with what Ada describes, or do you want to add any other perspectives on your sense of general engagement these days among young people?
My experience in the classroom was that students are really eager to learn about political issues and policy issues. And I actually like to make a bit of a distinction between policy and politics, because I think politics can be really off-putting sometimes, but policy, which are like the laws that govern how we have to live together, I think students are really interested in that, in learning about the issues that are challenging and complex and trying to figure out what kind of policies we could create to solve them. And so, I mean, that's what I just heard Ada talking about is, you know, a really important issue, gun violence, and students being engaged in thinking about what solutions would be possible. And because national solutions have hit a lot of roadblocks, students are looking for local solutions on that issue. And that's been my experience in high school and in college classrooms, is that students have a lot of interest. They know that the issues are complex. They really like to learn and have opportunities to dig in and discuss together.
So I think that that is a great segue to talk a little bit about the legislative semester, Kate, that students are eager for these experiences of learning about the legislative process and policy making. Tell us about how the legislative semester works and what its goals are.
Yeah, so the legislative semester is a high school government curriculum. It's used as the framework for teaching a semester-long government or civics class at 21 schools now. And the course was actually originally created in 1992, so it's not new, but it started in the Illinois suburbs, and we brought this course to Middleton High School in 2012. So that was the first time that a Wisconsin school used the course. And basically, students spend the whole semester learning about policy issues and researching and creating bills to respond to the problems that they see in the world around them. And then they go through the legislative process. So they write a bill, they have a committee hearing where the bill can be amended, and then they create a full legislature in their school. So it's like the Wisconsin Assembly or the House of Representatives, where they debate and vote on the bills. And throughout the whole process, students are really in control of the issues they're discussing, the policy proposals they're coming up with. Student leaders are responsible for managing the debate of all of these bills. And so it's really a student-centered curriculum. And that's one of the, I would say, the sort of philosophical pillars of the curriculum, is trying to really center student voice and student agency so that they start to develop the feeling that they can be part of the process.
And tell us a little bit more about where the legislative semester curriculum is being used now, particularly here in Wisconsin.
So in 2012, we started in Middleton, and then there has been growth a lot through word of mouth from teachers who knew each other, learned about the program, and were interested. And in 2022, we created a nonprofit organization, and that was a collaboration between a number of former teachers who felt like there's a real need for this program, and without any sort of formal organization, it was hard to support teachers who were interested. So since 2022, we've had a formal organization that's meant to help teachers who are interested in the program get it adopted at their schools. And that's been really successful. So it's spread pretty quickly in Dane County in recent years. Middleton started using it. Sauk Prairie also started about 10 years ago. But then recently, Oregon High School, McFarland High School, and DeForest High School have all adopted this course as a requirement for all students. So all students at those schools take the course as their required government class. And actually, at West High School, they just started a pilot of the legislative semester. Ada, I don't think you were in the class, but it was just one section where they are kind of testing this out to see if it's something that would fit at West High School into their curriculum.
Mm-hmm. So it is high school exclusive, right? This is designed for high school's 9th, 10th, 11th grades?
Yeah, you know, an interesting thing in Wisconsin and in most states too, each school district has some leeway in terms of how they design their curriculum. So in some schools, this is used as a senior class.
Okay.
And in some schools, in Middleton, when we started, it was sophomores who took the class. Now they've moved it to junior year. So every school, it's structured a little bit differently. But typically like 10th through 12th grade is where most of the schools are focused. Although we've definitely had middle school teachers who are interested, maybe not in adopting the whole program, but using some of the philosophies and some of the strategies to engage their students with discussion of policy issues. Because one of the really core elements of the course is near daily discussion of policy issues. So one of the things students are getting is a lot of opportunity to practice talking to each other about contentious policy issues.
And I definitely like to talk about that experience of talking a little bit more later on in the hour. We'll dive into sort of the process of civil discourse and how that's playing out these days in this context of this program and elsewhere. But I'd love for you to just kind of wrap up our introduction to the legislative semester, Kate, by telling us a little bit more about the kinds of learning that you've been able to document in this experience, both from the perspective of teachers and students. And then you also have some research-based evidence that you've gathered.
Yeah. I mean, I think oftentimes the most compelling evidence is just the stories from students and teachers, because what you hear from students is that this is their favorite class. They're so excited every day to come to class to be able to dig into these issues. It's just evidence that students are really kind of hungry for opportunities to learn about the broader world around them and how things work, how our government works, and how they can be a part of that. So students really love that because they have these daily opportunities to just talk about what they believe and also in that process kind of develop a better understanding of their belief systems in collaboration with their peers. You know, teachers really love this course as well. It changes the dynamics between teachers and students because teachers over time are passing a lot of responsibility on to their students and trying to take more of a facilitation role. And it's really amazing as a teacher to see the students stepping up and taking on that responsibility and with a lot of maturity. It's just a very different dynamic than you see in a typical classroom. There's also a lot of published research done by academic researchers that demonstrates some very positive impacts. So it's a unique position to be in to have academic research specifically on this curriculum. But Dr. Diana Hess, who was the dean of the UW School of Education prior to her time as the dean, she was a social studies education faculty, and she did some research on this program specifically and has written about it in both of her books. And what she found and what another UW researcher, Dr. Brett Levy, found is, you know, real verification of what teachers know when they teach this program. And that's that students are more interested in policy issues and learning about current issues after they take this class. They're more likely, they're sort of self-reported, more likely to vote. And they've even done follow-up studies after graduation to verify that. So, you know, they expect their reported expected future participation is greater, but then they actually do participate more. Students believe that they can make a difference and be involved in change. And these are results that are compared to students in a more traditional government class and also an AP government class. So these kind of outcomes are is like pretty robust research that was comparing students in this course to students who took other government courses. And then finally, and I think maybe most importantly, what we can come back to this later, is that research found that students are more open-minded after taking this class. And I think that's increasingly more and more important to figure out how we can create opportunities for young people to learn and develop their own ideas and also be willing to listen and be open-minded about other people's ideas. And that's just a huge outcome of this program, and one that's gained more significance over time, I think, because the willingness to listen to others is something that's, I think, broadly declined in our society.
Another sort of highlight that I hear you talking about there, Kate, is the idea of agency or self-efficacy, that students feel like they can do something after taking this semester immersion. Is that something you hear students talking about, is feeling a sense of empowerment?
Yeah, and not only is that something that, you know, we saw in the research that students reported that they felt more, that they had the skills to become involved, and they also believed that they could make a difference. But then you also just see students going out and doing that in the world. And so there was a young woman from Middleton High School who ran for school board. I think she was 22. She ran in a contested election, and she won a school board seat and served on the Middleton school board, and, you know, really represented a different kind of voice. And I think that that's a good example of, I think, how she, through this experience, just developed this belief that she could be a part of the decision-making structure in our democracy.
Yeah, we know that that belief, of course, is so important to getting people involved, but it also is important to just helping people feel good, feel like they have a sense of ability to change the direction of their lives and other people's lives.
Douglas, I wanted to actually come back to your original question about youth engagement and share a few statistics that came out of research after the last election and get Ada's kind of like impression about her, you know, experience related to some of the larger national trends. So, you know, youth voter turnout was actually down in 2024. In 2024, 42% of youth turned out to vote. And that's, I think that's not youth as in like 18 to 20. I believe that's 18 to 25, so younger voters. But 42% is down from over 50% in 2020. So that's a concerning trend from a civics education perspective. And they did some further research into why, and a third of students said they were uninterested. And I think that's uninterested, you know, deserves some interpretation, because my experience as a teacher is that they're not uninterested in the issues, right? But they might have been uninterested in the election and the candidates. You know, that 25% of students said they didn't like the candidates, and that was why they didn't vote. And 25% actually had a hard time registering to vote. So there were some barriers as well in terms of the ability to meet the deadlines, have the right documentation, understand the process of registering and voting. So I think that those are all like pieces of information that are important for us to consider when we're thinking about trying to elevate youth participation. And I know that's something really near and dear to Ada's heart.
Absolutely. And we will go to Ada Lambeck, Madison West High School senior, in just a moment, but I want to remind listeners first that you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Ada Lambeck and Executive Director of the Legislative Semester, Kate Ullman. If you have a question for my guests or want to share a perspective on civics education and youth engagement in democracy, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to have you join the conversation. So we're going to go to you, Ada, to respond to what Kate was just talking about in terms of those trends, and also just to begin telling us about the initiative that you have started, which is a great example of youth empowerment that we were just talking about. So I'll let you take it from there, Ada.
Yeah, so I think what you said with how students are interested in the policy and not the politics is so, so true. I mean, and those statistics you said, like, I'm not surprised at all. I think the last presidential election was a lot of politics. And like, I was door knocking for that election. And a lot of it was just politics stuff. And yes, you know, a lot of people didn't like each candidate entirely, you know, no one's perfect and there's always going to be something you don't like about them. But like, and also that they're uninterested and that they don't think it affects them. Like I had someone tell me once that the Supreme Court doesn't affect them, you know, so I think students need help drawing a direct connection between government action and their personal lives. And I feel like that's why I've been more civically engaged than other people my age, is because early on I was able to draw that connection that what the government does directly affects me. And that's why it's important to be engaged and to care about these things, for sure. And so when it comes to like civic engagement, at West High School, we've been doing voter registration drives, with the League of Women Voters. And the whole point of our club, the West Civics Club that we started my sophomore year, is to engage high schoolers and have them learn about politics and local issues for them to understand what's going on so that they can be educated and go vote and be educated about their vote and know what's going on around them. So we started recently an initiative to push for the state to pass a constitutional amendment that would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in school board elections, which makes a lot of sense when you think about it. I mean, students don't really have a say when it comes to school policy, and there's a huge disconnect between the students and the school board, who's actually making all of the decisions for us. And yes, we do have student representatives on the school board, and they do kind of have a vote. I mean, it's sort of like a recommendation vote. It doesn't go toward the final count tally, but they still get a vote, kind of. But allowing younger people to be able to vote for school board members would create a direct connection between the school board and the students, because 16 and 17-year-olds, these would be current students in the public system, right? So school board candidates would have to appeal to what the students want, and what changes they want to see if they want to be elected. So it's a direct way to give students a voice, which is why we're pushing for it, and it's super important.
Thank you for sharing both your perspective there and some of the work you've done to create forms for civic engagement there at Madison West and throughout Madison. Tell us a little bit more about that process then for that initiative to change the voting age for school board elections. Where is the process at now, and what would need to happen for that to happen?
Well, like I said before, it would have to be a constitutional amendment, because Wisconsin's constitution explicitly states that only 18-year-olds are allowed to vote in such and such elections, which includes school board. Which is why it would have to be a constitutional amendment. Now, there are other cities across the country who have been able to lower the voting age for their city for school board elections because it's not explicitly stated in their constitution. Several cities in Maryland have done it. Newark has done it. Oakland has done it in California. So it's happening in other places. And this would be like, if this works, it would be the first state to do it statewide. And so the process for that looks like the entire legislature, so both the Assembly and the Senate, would both have to pass the constitutional amendment in two different sessions before it would go on to the ballot for the voters to vote on during the next election. But getting it to the legislature is its whole process of its own, and it's probably going to take a couple of years. Right now, with the current legislature makeup, we wouldn't have the support we need to pass this amendment, which is why we're going to start by working with local school boards and cities to try and get their support for this constitutional amendment, and then put pressure on legislature and local like assembly members To push for this constitutional amendment. So right now, we have met with the Dane County Youth Commission, and they're going to be holding a hearing soon about passing a referendum in support of this constitutional amendment. And then after that, we will go to the Madison School Board and pressure them to pass a referendum in support. And then after that, we can go to Middleton, Verona, Oregon, and continue to expand, hopefully all the way up to Green Bay.
Great. You mentioned that you don't perceive that there's legislative support for this initiative now. Is it viewed as a partisan issue?
It is, unfortunately, partisan when it comes to voting rights. Republicans have been known to not be in support of lowering the voting age and expanding voting rights in general. And since they currently hold a majority, as slim as it is, it would still be hard to pass this kind of thing right now. And I've spoken with some Democrats in the assembly and, you know, also, like, frankly, right now they have bigger fish to fry. You know, they're not willing to spend their political capita on this right now, especially because there's not really a lot of support, you know, for it right now. It's not, you know, something that's on everyone's minds and that people are pushing for. They have bigger issues right now, which is why we need to, you know, take some time, wait a couple of years, but during that time, you know, start building support and momentum for this so that when the time is right, we can send it straight to the legislature and say, hey, do this and it'll happen.
Right. And do you expect to continue to stay involved, Ada, even after graduating high school?
Yes, I will definitely still be involved with this after I go to college. Yeah. Right.
You've been involved in lots of other ways, starting that Civics Club there at Madison West. And one of the things the Civics Club did this past fall was host town hall forums with Senator Tammy Baldwin and Libertarian challenger Phil Anderson. And you got to co-host those forums. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how it, what you learned from it, what you took away from it?
I mean, at first, when somebody else in the club floated the idea of having, you know, the Senate candidates come to West High School, I really didn't think it was realistic. You know, like, why would they want to come here? But, you know, as we dug into it more, it looked like it would be realistic, which was super exciting. But part of what the Civics Club does to engage high schoolers is we bring in leaders to hold town halls. So that students can know the candidates and what the political climate is like. Even if they're not eligible voters, it's still important for them to understand what's going on. And if they are eligible voters, it's an opportunity for them to learn more about who they're voting for and who their current leaders are. So that's why we wanted them to come in the first place. And we were so thrilled to host Tammy Baldwin and Phil Anderson at West High School. It was really amazing. And I know students learned a lot from it. They were, you know, conversation was like buzzing in the hallways. It was really nice to hear. I know somebody said, you know, I learned a lot, you know, like I didn't know Tammy Baldwin was a gun owner. I learned I need to research candidates. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, that's exactly what we're going for. You know, that's exactly the kind of reaction we want to hear. So yeah, it was really great to hear that.
And do you sense that politicians are willing to reach out to the younger than 18 audience? You know, after that, you were saying, oh, this didn't seem possible. Do you feel more empowered to say, hey, let's get politicians talking to high school students more?
Oh, for sure. And politicians really do care about the youth vote. I know Tammy Baldwin goes to UW semi-frequently to talk to the students there because she understands how important the youth vote is, especially because we have a much lower turnout. So there's much more to be gained from talking to youth voters. So there is quite a political advantage for coming to talk to the youth, especially because, you know, it might be their first couple times voting. So they haven't really formed an idea of what they're looking for yet in politics. So it's a good opportunity for politicians to come and talk to young voters. And yes, that is very helpful when we're trying to reach out to candidates. You know, we found they're usually very willing to come to West and talk to young people.
I want to reintroduce my guests quickly. That is Madison West High School senior Ada Lambeck, founder, or one of the founders, right, Ada?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of the West High School Civics Club. And we're also joined today here on A Public Affair by Kate Ullman, Executive Director of the Legislative Semester, a nonprofit organization that supports a semester-long high school government and civics curriculum. We would love to have you join the conversation. We still have plenty of time to hear your voice this hour. Give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. Kate Ullman, I'm going to turn it back to you to build on what Ada was just talking about. And then I have some other thoughts about talking about civil discourse in this particular time and both of your involvement in that. But go ahead, Kate.
Yeah, I wanted to loop back to the question you asked, Douglas, about the constitutional amendment and if it was seen as partisan.
Yeah.
I actually think, you know, it's important to really try to make sure that people understand that this isn't something with a partisan motivation. And I actually think that there's some new trends that help make that case. And one is that in the most recent presidential election, Kamala Harris got, I think, 4 percentage points more support among young voters than Donald Trump, which is a pretty small margin, actually, especially given the low turnout, like Ada just mentioned, that when the turnout is low and the margin is pretty close, there's really opportunities on both sides of the aisle there, right, to turn out voters that would vote for their party. So I think that helps make the case that, you know, this is not about a partisan effort. And also because their focus is on school board elections, which are nonpartisan elections. Again, we're not like, you know, there's not an effort to get youth out to vote for all elections, although I would support lowering the voting age generally myself, because I think the youth voice is really important. But in this case, this school board election, you know, it's a nonpartisan election. And I think there's a lot of really good arguments that have nothing to do with political ideology. Yeah. It, I would imagine that when Ada talks to people about this and when her peers talk to people, it's really more about overcoming some beliefs and perceptions about youth political engagement, their knowledge about the process, their ability to make decisions like this. But I think hearing Ada talk today, it's pretty clear that young people have the capability to deeply engage and consider the issues. And, you know, I think through those conversations, young people can make a good case to people on both sides of the aisle who might be skeptical that they deserve a voice in a school board election where the outcome affects them. And I think that's a real foundational principle of democracy, is that people get a voice in the decisions that impact them. So I think that's, you know, a great case to be made for the effort that those students are making.
Yeah, let's dig into that effort a little bit more. I'm glad you brought up those points, Kate, and I want to turn back to you, Ada, because what Kate is saying is really important, that school board elections are not partisan or politicized in the same ways that other kinds of elections are. And so the motivations for students wanting to participate in them might look a little different. What are the things that motivated the Madison West Civics Club to want to advocate for this particular change in voting regulations? In what ways are people concerned about having a voice on the school board?
Yeah, so when it comes to like school board, I mean, the school board affects students directly, and students deserve to have a say about that kind of thing. We decided to sort of take this up because, sort of like Kate said before, like it's just the school board and it's nonpartisan. It's not like we're trying to lower the voting age for all elections, which would be more controversial. So it's sort of like a small stepping stone to further expanding more rights if that's what, you know, you wanted to do. And it's a small step, but it's so important for students to be able to have that voice. And, you know, there's research that shows, you know, if you vote earlier and in local elections, mm-hmm. you're more likely to be, you make it a lifelong habit. So it's also sort of about, you know, engaging voters while they're young so that they continue to participate throughout the democratic process. And like when it comes to opposition, like You know, sometimes people think, you know, we just don't understand politics. You know, we're too young. We don't pay taxes all the time. You know, I haven't had to pay taxes yet, fortunately. But that because we don't pay taxes that, you know, we don't deserve a say in how money is spent, which I think is a bit backwards. But, you know, so and so. There's other things as well, but that one is a main one. In addition, with like students not being informed enough, that's a big one. And, you know, for that, you know, like West has a civics course now, you know, that is required to graduate. So kids are going to have to learn about civics, and they'll probably do it during their like junior year, which is when they'll be 16, 17 years old. So they will have had this civics education before they go to the polls. So they will know. And, you know, like, let's be honest, you know, not every adult is civically educated, you know. So, you know, students will likely be more civically educated than other people older than them. So there's that as well. Yeah.
Well, the other thing I would add to that is just that what do students know better than the content of education, right? And how education is administered. You spend your whole lives, you know, immersed in that environment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're experts in that regard, I would say. But Kate, you wanted to jump in as well.
Yeah, well, and Ada cited this research that shows that, you know, early voting participation predicts later voting participation. So like helping youth learn how to register and vote for the first time helps predict like a lifetime of voting behavior. So I think that's a really good reason to try to figure out how we can help young people develop that habit and feel like they are a part of democracy through their vote. And I think the statistic that 25% of youth didn't vote because they had trouble figuring out how to register and vote is a really good reason to think about schools as a real opportunity. And in fact, last year there was a bipartisan bill introduced in the Wisconsin Assembly that would reinstate voter registration deputies in our high schools in Wisconsin. So up until 2011, might have been 2010, all Wisconsin schools were required to have a person who was deputized to register voters in the school, and they could register students or staff or anyone. And that law was repealed. And so there was a bipartisan bill to reintroduce that because it's another way to support youth kind of overcoming that barrier of registering for the first time, because young people do face some special challenges in our state in terms of the requirements to show that they are a resident. So when you register, you have to establish residency. And for a younger person, that can be more challenging. So having support through the school would be a really great way to do that. And I'm sure that Ada has some experience because they've been doing voter registration drives in the school. Maybe she can speak to that.
Yeah, go ahead, Ada.
Yeah, I was, I just wanted to add on to that. Like it is hard for younger people to register to vote, especially if they don't have a driver's license, because you need to have proof of address on an official government document. So if you don't have a driver's license and you don't pay taxes, there's no way to prove your address through official government documentation. Now, I believe the school can draw up some sort of document to help you with that sort of issue. But that's one thing. And like, I have a friend who has Tourette's syndrome, so he can't drive. Already that puts him at a disadvantage for registering to vote, right? Because he won't have a driver's license as a proof of address. So he'll have to, you know, take extra steps in order to register, which is very difficult, you know. So that is a disadvantage young people are put at. And also sort of what you were saying before, you know, another good reason for, you know, lowering the voting age for just school board elections is it's less overwhelming than, say, you know, like a general election ballot when there's like five different races going on, you know, at least maybe. And so, and, you know, it's only like two, maybe three candidates, you know, in the primary, and that you have to research and know about. And it's a good first experience for voting because it's a lot less overwhelming and you learn how to do it. Yeah.
That's also a great point. I had not thought about both of the points that both of you are making, that this is such an important way to introduce and get people involved at an early age in the political process, and that has lasting implications. One more shout out for folks listening today. If you want to join the conversation, there's still time. Give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We're talking about civics education and youth engagement in democracy here on A Public Affair today with Madison West High School senior Ada Lambeck and Kate Ullman, who is the executive director of the legislative semester. And we're going to turn back to the legislative semester now and play a real short clip from one of the testimonials for the legislative semester of two Middleton High School teachers being interviewed by Wisconsin Eye, talking about the role of parliamentary procedure and civil discourse in the legislative semester. And I think this will be a good lead-in for us to talk a little bit about some of the hard stuff about having conversations about difficult issues in the context of the classroom. Is there anything you wanted to add to set up this clip, Kate, about who we're hearing here?
We can just listen and I can share.
Sure. Yeah. All right.
Then on session days, how do you get sophomores to honor time limits? Because I witness people, the timekeeper, the parliamentarian, interrupting people, your time is up, and your students respectfully stop talking. I don't see that in the Wisconsin's capital. So,
the kids are shocked when they watch actual legislators at play, because they are shocked that they don't honor the gavel, because we teach them this is why the gavel exists. This is how, you know, civil discourse works. And I mean, it's so often the case, right? We say, oh, you know, do as I say, not as I do, sort of from an adult perspective. Mm-hmm. And the kids are often really shocked and disappointed. So we just encourage them. So when now you go out and do better, I mean, we just make it an assumption from the beginning that you're going to, you know, use civil discourse, respect the timer, respect the gavel. And if they respect their leadership, which they typically do because it's, you know, the people they elected, then they follow it. We have had instances where kids have overspoken and the Speaker of the House has threatened to throw them out of full session. And that sort of shuts it down usually.
We spend a significant amount of time talking about why civil discourse is important to having an informed discussion, why it's important to solving problems so that we can, instead of nibble around the edges of things, actually attack things head on. And I think setting that foundation along with using the gavel and parliamentary procedure facilitates itself more than anything else.
So we were just hearing two Middleton High School teachers in a Wisconsin Eye interview talking about the role of parliamentary procedure and civil discourse in the legislative semester. Kate, tell us a little bit more about your sense, building on what we just heard, of how the environment of the legislative semester helps navigate the levels of political dysfunction and partisanship and polarization that we witness in the public sphere right now.
Yeah, so as you heard those teachers saying, in the legislative semester, every class period and every discussion of a bill or an issue is conducted using parliamentary procedure as if you were in a public meeting, like a school board or a city council or something like that. You've got 20 students in the room, you've got a chair who's facilitating. And that's really important because in order to talk about difficult issues or issues where people disagree, you really need a structure to do that. And there's a lot of other ways to facilitate discussion in classrooms, but we use parliamentary procedure because it's authentic, because that's the real way that in our government at almost every level, discussions are facilitated. And so we also really work hard to help students understand that it's not just like something that's meant to make it awkward and difficult to talk. Sometimes parliamentary procedure is a little off-putting for people. The language can be formal. But once students get accustomed to it, which takes just a few days, really, and the teachers help them understand that parliamentary procedure really creates more equity of voice in the classroom. So when someone has the floor, they get uninterrupted speaking time. And that's really important because in other contexts, in classrooms and in public, people are interrupted or shouted down, right? And that's just not acceptable in this format. And so parliamentary procedure creates this structure where everyone gets their time to have their voice heard. It also ensures that all voices are heard, and so that anyone who wants to speak on the issue has an opportunity. Before someone can speak twice, everyone else gets to speak once. You know, so there's rules that are meant to ensure that all ideas are heard and given a fair hearing. And teachers really emphasize it. You heard Andy Hartman, who's still a teacher at Middleton, emphasize that civil discourse is important because it helps everyone stay in the conversation and be able to engage around these difficult issues without getting to a point where they can no longer participate because it's gotten too heated. You know, so issues that students are discussing are really personal sometimes, but those structures, those really formal structures of parliamentary procedure, not only does it help them learn how it really works in the real world, in our democracy, but it also gives them that framework to stay in the conversation and navigate that disagreement, and they learn and practice those skills, because it's not something that comes naturally to any of us, honestly, right? You got to have a commitment to really working through the issues, but also learn and practice how to respectfully disagree with each other. What kind of language can you use when you disagree with someone and you want to, be able to voice that in a respectful way, and to be open-minded and curious about what other people think, so that, all ideas can get a fair hearing.
I want to have Ada follow up a little bit about talking about difficult issues in the current climate, but we do have a caller that I want to bring into the conversation. Dave, you are on A Public Affair.
Thank you very much. I wanted to let you know that the state of Wisconsin Department of Transportation, the people who give out driver's licenses, also give out state ID cards. It's very much like a driver's license, but it doesn't give you a driving privilege. It just is an ID card that you need to have. For the first time, you need a birth certificate. But it's free for, there was actually a court case, or I don't know how it happened, but it's no charge. So if you're a high school student, 18 or over, even if you don't intend to drive, you can get a state ID card to vote. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in and sharing that, Dave. We'll go to you now, Ada, and feel free to comment on Dave, or just go ahead with talking about what you just heard from Kate.
Well, yeah, first of all, thank you, Dave. That's a really great resource for students, and I'll be sure to share that with them. And going with what Kate said, I think, I agree with, and from personal experience in the classroom, we do discuss tough issues a lot. West is, in a pretty blue partisan area, so there's not usually a lot of discourse over issues. There's usually a sense of mutual agreement, which does make it easier to have those discussions, because you feel like you're, in a place where your voice can be heard. But then that also goes backwards on the people who do not feel like their voice can be heard, because they feel the opposite. So it does go both ways there. From the most part, students are very open to having these tough conversations and listening to the other side. And it's a really important skill to just be able to listen to somebody you don't agree with, and just be able to sit there quietly, actually listen to their concerns and respond to their concerns genuinely, and not just like, oh, well, you're wrong, So it's really great to hear about what you've been seeing in the classroom. That really makes me happy.
Yeah, Kate, I know you have thought a lot about the challenges of doing civics education in homogeneous versus heterogeneous environments. It would be great to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I think what Ada said is oftentimes seems to be a challenge for teachers and for students, that if you live in a more politically homogenous community, then it might seem harder to really give a fair hearing to both sides of an issue. But there's actually a lot of research that shows that students, and all of us probably, have more diverse political views than we might initially think. And even as an example, at West, I visited West in January, and I listened to the students debating the bills they had written for their pilot of the legislative semester in their civics course. And I was frankly quite surprised to see the diversity of opinions in the room on issues like gun control and immigration, pretty politically charged issues. There were really diverse opinions among the, you know, 15 students that were talking about those issues. And because I, like most people, made some assumptions about what I would see at Madison West High School based on sort of the political makeup of the community, I think that is a good lesson that, like, Republican and Democrat are just two very rough buckets that people fall into, right? And people's views are so much more nuanced and the issues are so much more complex than just like, oh, either or. And so I think when you give students opportunities in a real structured way to validate different opinions, to make it okay to have different opinions, okay to change your mind, you know, as you learn more and hear what others have to say, what comes out is that these complex issues, they're not easy to solve and there's not like real agreement necessarily, because it's more complicated than just like what the Democrats and the Republicans say on that issue.
Ada?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, students actually do a good job of like understanding both sides of the argument. You know, it's one thing to believe what you do, but to understand both sides of the argument is, you know, more challenging. And they do have the ability to see where the other side is coming from and argue that with reasoning, because there is a reason, you know, that somebody does, you know, thinks the opposite of what you do. And it's an important skill. And, you know, in addition, like, even if we are sort of like in consensus about, you know, like a broader issue, yeah, like, yes, this thing should happen, there's always a debate with like how or when, you know, with what money, you know. So there's like, you know, there's debate within that, which I think kind of goes to what you're saying about, you know, like very diverse opinions. Like we might agree on, you know, the top level about an issue, but we might not agree on how to handle it. So, you know, that's always very interesting to hear what peers have to say about that and their ideas.
I think that's actually what like really combats cynicism among young people about politics, because when they have the opportunity to dig into that and realize that like making policy is very complex, that we have to like actually come up with a workable solution. So maybe you believe that we need some gun control reform, but that's not enough, right? There's a lot that has to go into, like Ada just said, when and why and how, and you know, and so I think that when students really start to understand that, it makes them understand that like, oh, there's a role for participating in those conversations. And if that's something that's important in the legislative semester is the idea of deliberation, that we're trying to give a fair hearing to both multiple perspectives before we really try to come to a conclusion or form an opinion. That's something that's really baked into the legislative semester, but also other like curriculum and civics education discussion strategies that really focus on deliberation. It's not about winning and losing. It's about like really exploring the issue and understanding it to try to come up with a good solution.
We're going to have to slowly move towards wrapping up the hour here. But before we do that, I want to make sure both of you get to share a little bit about how to get involved. Kate, if teachers or students listening want to get involved in the legislative semester, how can they do so?
Well, we have a website. It's easy, legislativesemester.org. So that's a great way to just learn more about the program and, you know, contact me through that website. My contact information is there. And we're, you know, our whole mission is to support other schools who are interested in adopting this program in their communities. And I'm also lead the Wisconsin Civic Learning Coalition. You can like Google that too. We have a website for the Wisconsin Civic Learning Coalition, which is just engaged more broadly in advocacy about how we can strengthen civic learning in our state in a nonpartisan way and a bipartisan way. I'd welcome anyone to reach out and talk with me more about either of those efforts.
Great. And Ada, I know you wanted to do a quick response. And then also, how can students get involved in the Voting Age Change Initiative?
Well, yeah, just I wanted to say quickly with what Kate was saying before is like, and this sort of goes back to your like policy versus politics idea, is that when something does happen on like a national scale, people are like, oh, it's not enough or it's too much, which goes back to what you were saying before about how like students understand like how like complicated these things are. And like there's a lot more to just saying, yes, we agree on this. You know, there's more that has to happen. But in terms of ways people can get involved, I mean, we'll be having hearings about referendums in support of our constitutional amendment, and we will be posting on our social media, Madison West Civics Club, about when those are, and if you want to come and testify in support of those referendums, we welcome anybody, students, adults, doesn't matter. All of that would be really great.
That is Madison West High School senior Ada Lambeck, also Madison, member of the Madison West High School Civics Club. Thanks so much for being here today, Ada.
Thank you.
And we've also had with us today Kate Ullman, executive director of the Legislative Semester, Inc., a nonprofit organization that supports a semester-long high school government and civics curriculum. Thanks so much for joining us, Kate.
Thank you so much, Douglas, and thank you for bringing Ada into the studio, too. It's just been really wonderful to have this conversation.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure having the dialogue with both of you today. And I want to thank listeners as well for joining us. If you've appreciated the show today, please share it on WORT's online archive or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm your host, Douglas Haynes, and I'd like to thank today's engineer, Andrew Thomas, producer Sarah Gabler, news director Shali Pittman, and receptionist Amy Lutzke. You have been listening to A Public Affair here at WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Book Beat. Yeah.
Pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted.
I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. President Erdogan says the demonstrations in support of the jailed Istanbul mayor have turned into a movement of violence. He said Turkey's main opposition party was responsible for damaging property and harming police officers and vowed it would be held accountable. Turkish police said they detained 1,100 people who took part in protests against the arrest last week of Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Our correspondent Orla Girin has been meeting some of the protesters in central Istanbul.
You can still get the smell of the tear gas that was fired yesterday. Many of those who've gathered here now